You are listening to Catch the Current,
the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione.
Before we dive in, a quick shout out to our sponsor, Wisefish. With over 30 years in the seafood industry, they're powering aquaculture, fisheries, processors, and seafood sales with one integrated platform that makes managing complex operations simpler. Check them out at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent. Lauren, I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm a pretty big bingo player. I take my 91.
Wild girl.
Take my 91-year-old grandma out with me and we have a great time. But I got to tell you, what happened this week was not on my 2025 bingo card.
It has got to be the radioactive shrimp.
The radioactive shrimp. It took me some time to wrap my head around the original import alert that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, released because it was a first of its kind alert. You know, we've been in the seafood industry now, Lauren, for 8 years now, and I've never seen anything like this.
We keep getting one-upped, but this will be pretty tough to beat. So a lot is still unfolding, but we're breaking down everything we know so far, including this import alert 9951.
Yes. So 9951 was published on August 14th and is described as detention without physical examination of human food products that appear to have been prepared, packed, or held under insanitary conditions, resulting in chemical contamination. So I talked to sources who explained that this alert 9951 was created specifically for the issue encountered with major Indonesian seafood processor Bahari Makmur Sajati, also known as BMS. The problem is listed as CCM-137 or CS-137. And the example that the FDA gives in its alert for CS-137 is that elevated amounts can be present at locations where contamination settled from accidents such as Chernobyl in 1986 and Fukushima in 2011. Those are two events that you do not want to see in an import alert.
You watched the Chernobyl show.
That was a great show.
I couldn't even finish it because it scared me.
So it was super scary. Yeah.
I'm having some PTSD here. But we're talking about Indonesian shrimp grown in ponds in Indonesia and nowhere near nuclear events that occurred like Chernobyl and Fukushima. So how is this shrimp getting contaminated? Well, let's start with talking a little bit more about CS-137. It's a radioisotope created via nuclear reactions, but while it generally occurs in nuclear power plants, the FDA also notes that it is commonly used in medical and other industrial applications. Exposure to CS-137 can be harmful to the body, even in low doses spread out over a period of time. High doses can lead to acute radiation syndrome, and the FDA says that the primary concern, though, is cancer. The import alert goes on to state that the FDA considers the totality of the circumstances on a case-by-case basis to determine whether a food appears to have been prepared, packed, or held under insanitary conditions, whereby it has become contaminated with a chemical contaminant that may have rendered it injurious to health. And the FDA ultimately decided to add BMS to its red list, meaning all of its products are subject to detention without physical examination.
One source I talked to early this week said that they anticipate this ban of products from BMS to be a big hit for retail, as it's the largest supplier of Easy Peel shrimp to the U.S. Before I could even report that, news broke that the FDA was urging Walmart, a huge player in the grocery game with nearly 4,600 locations, to recall three different lots of products that include frozen raw shrimp from BMS and sold under its Great Value brand. So yes, a big hit for retail indeed.
Joining us now on the pod to talk more about the potential impact on the market is Undercurrent News editorial director Cliff White and Undercurrent News price analyst Gary Morrison. Gary, the first question is for you. Tell us a little bit about Indonesia in general as a player in the U.S. shrimp market.
Well, Lauren, they're a pretty important player. Indonesia is the third largest source country of shrimp imports into the United States. They sent nearly 300 million pounds, valued at $1.1 billion to the U.S. in 2024. Over the last 10 years, they've averaged roughly 19% market share of U.S. shrimp imports. So I know I said they were the number three source country. They were number two for a long time up till about 2021 when Ecuador overtook them. So a pretty important trade partner with the U.S. From the Indonesian producer perspective, the U.S. market is the most important. It is the largest market for Indonesian exports for shrimp. But the key issue with this new development for the Indonesian shrimp industry as a whole is it's very consolidated. The top four companies in that country, with BMS right there at the top, account for around 60% of the trade with the United States. So you're taking out a pretty big player, the number one player in a 60% market share. And it's not only the company, right, but the specific products and forms that are coming here. It's increasingly black tiger shrimp. And for Vaname, it's forms like Easy Peel, which we mentioned earlier in the pod, that's BMS being the top provider of this type of shrimp to the US, and Cook that dominate the trade. And these types of shrimp have been already tough to replace. So this is going to make it even more difficult. In response to the news this week, US wholesale prices reacted with significant gains in these types of shrimp. And these factors point to a continued firm market. So it's going to be a challenging time, especially for retailers that look for Easy Peel shrimp as one of their top, products.
I was just going to say, it sounds like there's going to be a big shakeup in the shrimp markets because of this.
Yeah, I think, obviously there's a lot of things going on. It's going to impact what companies can do business right now in the US, and can some of these other companies in Indonesia fill that void when they're already trading with the US in great quantities, right? So the other, three out of the other four top countries are already significant players here. Do they have enough product with their other trade to make up, that shortfall?
And another thing I feel like you have to factor into all this too is the tariffs. Cliff, you're our tariff guy, updating the blog almost every day for us. Indonesia was on the lower end of the tariff side from Trump's hits, correct?
It's about in the middle. I think it's 19%. Gary can correct me on that. But yeah, I would say it's about average, slightly higher than Ecuador at 15% and slightly lower than some of the other Asian countries at 20%. So not nothing, but not egregious. Well, some exporters may say it's all egregious, but yeah, it's right in the middle.
If Indonesia is now losing this market, directing people potentially towards these other markets that even have lower tariffs, they could potentially be losing.
I mean, it's going to be tough, right, Amanda? I mean, the tariffs are one thing, but it's really the product form. So Ecuador, which has that really big advantage over Indonesia, typically does not produce Easy Peel or Cooked, and they don't produce Black Tiger. So there's going to have to go to some other Asian source countries, which may be right around, that tariff rate.
There's so much stuff shifting around across the world of seafood. Shrimp is really interesting to follow from a journalistic perspective. There's so many countries that produce it, and they're all now at different or slightly different tariff rates. They also have, you're talking about anti-dumping duties, countervailing duties. Each of these countries has different product specializations. You've got wild shrimp, also an interesting alternative for buyers. You've got black tiger shrimp versus Vaname. I'm jealous that Gary gets to follow this so closely because it's so interesting once you get into the world of seafood to follow what's going to be happening over the next 6 months to 2 years to see how trade flows change because of these tariffs.
I agree with you. It's extremely interesting. And then when you add radioactive into the mix,
Amanda, you're positively glowing
You're
right
going.
now.
I mean, I want to get down to it. Is that how did this shrimp get contaminated? Because that's the real question here. And I can tell you with certainty that an investigation is underway. An advisory that was released a few days ago after the import alert states that the FDA is actively investigating reports of CS-137 contamination in frozen shrimp products processed by BMS, as well as shipping containers. And this isn't like one container, one location type of thing. I mean, Gary, you're always looking at, where all these ports are. It's this impact. This is four ports, shipping containers at four US ports: Los Angeles, Houston, Savannah, and Miami.
Yeah, so I mean, the producers that I talk to, obviously, they're awaiting, this investigation, pretty closely, because, they're saying that the containers, where they started, weren't washed correctly. So, that's their story, and obviously they're, holding out for a positive investigation for their end, because they just have no idea how this,
It's
radioactive substance was found, because it wasn't anywhere near where they source, where they farm and produce, or they process the shrimp.
Again, I want to reiterate the investigation is active. What we do know right now is that the FDA did collect multiple samples. And one of the interesting things, though, to note is that they confirmed the presence of CS137 in one sample of breaded shrimp. But again, it was one sample. They didn't detect it in the other products tested, but the FDA said they cannot rule out contamination because of that. So it could, like Gary said, it could be a container issue. But what the government agency did confirm is that all containers and products testing positive or alerting for CS137, they have been detained entry into the country. Of course, that didn't stop the FDA from urging Walmart to issue the recall. The FDA says that it learned that Walmart received implicated raw frozen shrimp imported after the date of first detection of CS137 by CBP, but from shipments that did not alert from CS137. So that's why the FDA recommended Walmart recall that shrimp. But again, just to reiterate, it's not all shrimp at Walmart. There's certain lots, certain states. So check the show notes for those details. Aquaculture is evolving fast, and managing fish farming alongside processing, sales, and logistics means handling complex data daily. WiseFish offers an integrated platform built specifically for aquaculture and seafood businesses. It collects data from farms, linking biological and financial insights so you can track costs and yields clearly. The system captures, for example, feed and medication usage, biomass increase, mortality, labor and equipment costs to give a full picture of profitability. It also supports planning across harvest, sales, and deliveries, helping you make smart decisions with accurate, up-to-date info. By replacing spreadsheets and siloed systems, WiseFish reduces manual work and errors, freeing time to focus on growth. Whether scaling or optimizing workflows, WiseFish helps improve efficiency and control costs without disrupting your existing systems. Learn more at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent.
Amanda, where do we go from radioactive shrimp?
Tariffs.
Yes.
If there's anything that could beat radioactive shrimp, it's Trump and his tariffs. So, Cliff, there was some tariff breaker news right before we went on to record this. So, what is the latest there?
The US and European Union put out a joint statement on the Thursday morning, and high up in the statement is a mention of seafood. Seafood, according to this agreement, which is not formalized but is in the process of being formalized, will have to go through a vote of the European Parliament. But if that happens under the dictates of this agreement, all US seafood will go to the EU tariff-free starting September 1st. I don't think this agreement will be finalized by that time, but will be retroactive to September 1st. So US exporters suddenly have a much better angle to get their products into the EU, as there were many types of US seafood that previously faced tariffs going to Europe.
Yeah, I think that Cliff is right. I think the access becomes better, right? And I think pollock and lobster are the two, largest exports to the European Union as a whole. So at least from the lobster market, I can talk. I mean, Canada's been shipping live to the EU under recent agreements, but the people that I talk to indicate that we may see more live lobster come into the US now for processing, which would allow frozen, tails and meat to head over to Europe untariffed. So still a developing story, but certainly better access with no tariffs is a positive sign and welcome by those in the industry.
Thanks, Cliff. Thanks, Gary. More on the latest tariff news in the show notes. Cliff, before you go, last week we had Gary on, and he sorely disappointed us with his tale of how he incorporated seafood, or rather failed to incorporate seafood, into his family vacation to Croatia. Cliff, please tell us you've come back from Scotland with tales of juicy langostinos and salmon.
Yeah, I didn't need to eat any US seafood in Scotland. I ate all the local stuff there. Scotland is, I think, an underrated seafood mecca. I feasted there. So I had obviously farm salmon, local farm salmon. It's cool they mention the locality where the salmon is farmed on a lot of menus there, which you don't see in the US. Kind of neat. Had some delicious oysters, mussels, crab. The local crab there is really good. But my super all-time new favorite seafood is langoustines. They're like little mini lobsters. They're also called Norway lobsters. They kind of look like mutate crawfish. They're so delicious. Oh my gosh. I don't know if we could get some here in the US. I think that's probably blasphemy living in Maine to think about that. But yeah, I would totally buy those things whenever I could. They're so delicious.
I'm pretty sure Lauren and I had a lang I call them langostinos. Apologize to anybody who I offend with that. I think Lauren and I had it on a Red Lobster pizza once.
Yes, we did.
That's one of the reasons why I love the Boston Seafood Show is because Scotland usually has this really nice setup booth. And a couple, actually, maybe it was Barcelona a couple of years ago. I feasted and I was able to eat some of the langoustines and man, they were delicious.
I've seen those at trade shows for a decade, but never somehow managed to eat any of them. So needless to say, there was much anticipation ordering these things, and I thought they were pretty good value, actually. I mean, especially compared to like European lobster, like Scottish lobster is like 40 euros at least. So I think these were like, we got six of them for like 30 euros. And they're a lot of work. I won't deny, like, there was a lot of anticipation as we were cracking into these things, but it was so worth it. Really good.
I think I know why you never had a chance to try these at the trade shows. It's because if you probably look at Lauren and I's output compared to Cliff's of like story output, it's like, how come Cliff submitted 50 stories and Amanda and Lauren over here like snapping pictures of every piece of like food we
Oh, no, you guys are just
We have a social
taking
aspect to
pictures. Yeah, you guys are just taking pictures and matching outfits always.
Hey.
I have
How dare
noticed the
you?
seafood from Scotland assignment fills very quickly on the spreadsheet. There's a lot of competition to get into that seafood from Scotland booth, so maybe I'll have to be on it earlier next year.
All right. This week we have one more special guest joining us, Undercurrent EMEA editor Neil Ramsden. But before Neil joins us, Lauren, Gary, any final market thoughts?
So I'll give an update on scallops. I haven't done that in a while. Scallops are trending smaller as we move into fall. Most of the fleet is focused on closed areas one and two. Closed area one is shutting down mid-November. We do that. We see that every year. Not uncommon. Area one is coming out of spawn. Some of the landings are still showing that milky condition, but that's been waning. As waters get colder, the scallops shrink, which means that there'll be more 10 to 20s, 20 to 30 meats in the market. Large scallops are still hard to come by and continue to command firm premiums. In New Bedford, landings rebounded in week 33 to just over 330,000 pounds, worth nearly $6 million. Dock prices eased slightly, and we're also seeing the price gap between 10 to 20s and 20 to 30s narrow as buyers lean more heavily on mid-range meats. For the wholesale market, despite softer raw values at the docks, wholesale prices are holding firm, especially in week 34, which we're in. Scarcity in large counts and steady food service demand continue to underpin the market. Normally, importers lean heavily on Japanese scallops when US supply tightens, but it doesn't look like that's able to happen this year. Japanese product is already expensive due to weaker harvests, high domestic processing costs, and unfavorable exchange rates. And then you add on that 15% US tariff, and it effectively prices out many US buyers. So importers are delaying contracts, leaving the US with fewer alternatives to fill that gap. Census data from the Undercurrent News trade portal shows US scallop imports have been declining month over month since February. So, looking ahead, the fishery is still expected to exceed early projections for the 2025-2026 season. There was a surprise boom out of Nantucket Lightship West back in May that gave the season a little bit of a lift, but that seems like a one-off event, unless we see some major storm like we're, kind of in the middle of right now, uncover hidden beds, but no one's expecting another surge like we saw back in May. Framework 39 originally set the harvest cap at 19.75 million pounds, but once you back out observer and research set asides, that leaves it closer to 18 million for the limited access fleet. So overall, more smaller scallops, fewer larger scallops. Japanese imports are kind of off the table at this point. And a domestic fishery that's on pace to beat expectations, but it still feels tight and unpredictable heading into the autumn season.
Lauren's analysis can be found in our show notes. Gary, any final market thoughts?
Nothing on the market. It just seems that each week the The seafood industry is dealing with something outside of what they can control, right? So it's really good to have a team like Undercurrent behind you to keep up to date on what's going on, and the companies can stay informed and agile.
Joining us now is Undercurrent EMEA editor Neil Ramsden, who's calling us from Trondheim, Norway for aquaculture technology event AquaNor 2025. This event runs from August 19th to the 21st. So we're catching you after a very long day, Neil. But for those who aren't familiar with AquaNor, tell us a little bit about this event.
Yeah, so it's Norway and I'm tempted to say the world's biggest kind of trade fair and conference for all things aquaculture technology, basically. And it's feeling pretty international this year. I've been speaking to a delegation from New Zealand. There's Canadians, Chileans. So yeah, I've not done this event for a few years now, and it was a lot more international this time than it was last time.
Oh, wow, that's really interesting. And I love, when you get to cover an event for multiple years in a row and you can see how it evolves. And I mean, you can't ignore all the global things happening right now. I mean, one of your latest posts is about how the US tariffs are impacting New Zealand businesses. Were tariffs top of mind at the event, or what was the big topic that everyone was talking about this year?
So the big kind of the thing that's affecting more or less everybody at Aquanor, I think, is pretty Norway-centric, really. But that's that the Norwegian government has brought in new salmon farming regulations. And I'm sure I'm just scratching the surface of what is going on. But yeah, the under the new regulations, I think salmon farmers are basically gearing up to really increase the precision and monitoring of what they do. I'm sure it hasn't felt, especially to them, like oversight has been relaxed in recent years, but it's going to require the farmers to pay even more attention to really full data collection and then using that data to prove full compliance to the new regulations. I spoke to one M&A expert today who suggested that that's going to mean more kind of capital expenditure up front at the start of each salmon farming cycle on just technology to monitor. But then if it's done right, that should mean lower operating expenditure sort of throughout the cycle and at the end of it. But because of that, we've seen a few businesses at the event focused on really the digital side of aquaculture. So monitoring what happens in the pens and kind of real time feeding that information back. So yeah, I think that's looking like the direction that things are going to move even more towards is more data, probably more AI to parse that data. Yeah, and the other thing is the Norwegian government is looking to bring mortalities down to under 5%, which means that kind of understanding fish health and then tools and initiatives to look at fish health and help them stay healthy, probably going to get more attention and more funding than ever.
Wow, so this seems like it was an event full of all good things. There's no concerns about where this funding is coming from, or where businesses can keep up.
Well, obviously the Norwegian salmon farmers have kind of received new taxes just in recent years, but the fact that they would maybe dispute with me is that they still maintain pretty healthy profits every quarter at this point. So, of all of the global aquaculture sectors, they're the ones that can really afford to kind of look into this sort of innovation and moving into the digital space. So, in a decade, perhaps this could be filtering down to shrimp aquaculture and that sort of thing. The guys that maybe don't have so much money to throw at it at the moment.
So be sure to check out Neil's live blogging from the event, AquaNor 2025, right at the top of our website. Thanks, Neil, for joining in, and safe travels home.
Thank you very much.
Before we go, I've got one more story to talk about that made national headlines this week, and that's Cracker Barrel. The Lebanon, Tennessee headquartered restaurant chain, which has over 650 locations across the US, has been struggling in recent years and this week unveiled a new logo to go along with its new fall menu. The logo is getting mixed results from fans. Lauren, have you seen it?
I have not.
So Lauren hasn't seen it. So
I'm Googling right now.
So I'll explain it because you should look it up. They got rid of the barrel.
And the guy in the chair next to the barrel. They just modernized it a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, people are upset about it. Honestly, I don't really care. Have you ever been to a Cracker Barrel?
I have not.
Oh my gosh. I have been, and there is one in New Jersey, and I feel like that's
there
like,
is?
Yes. But I feel like you can't go to it. I feel like it can only be like a thing you go to in the southern states, you know, and I've only gone to it whenever I've been like driving south. So I went to it a couple of times on my way to Tennessee and stuff. I've stopped at different ones and they're fun. They're great. They have like little games inside for the kids to play. Like I've ate there with like my parents back in the day. But why it matters to us is that Cracker Barrel has quite a few seafood offerings on its lunch and dinner menu, from shrimp to cod, catfish, and rainbow trout. But with the return of Uncle Herschel's favorite to its fall breakfast menu, it's getting seafood back at breakfast, which is really cool. So seafood traditionally hasn't stood as an American breakfast staple, although, you know, we've got smoked salmon and, you know, some crab and eggs. I feel like that's like a normal thing to do. Shrimp and grits, oysters and grits. I like that. But catfish at breakfast, not really like a normal popular choice, except for supposedly in the South. And that's kind of what inspired Cracker Barrel to bring it back. It's in line with what Cracker Barrel Chief Marketing Officer Sarah Moore said, that the restaurant aims to deliver the country nostalgia experience while leaning into seasonal flavors. So they want the country nostalgia experience, but all the while updating a logo.
Right, but taking it out of the logo.
But again, we're all for adding, you know, like I said, there's already seafood on breakfast menus, but it's cool to add catfish. You know, that's not a normal one. So like, I'd be interested in maybe we'll do a road trip. Like I said, it's not like a real Cracker Barrel experience if you're not eating in the South, but I'll take you to one in New Jersey, Lauren.
All right. That's awesome. You're very good at these last minute stories where I'm like, where is she going with this? And then you tie it all into seafood and it's—
Just hop on the train. Right. You'll always enjoy the ride, yeah. I promise.
I'm always pleasantly surprised. So that does it for us this week. For links to stories and more information, visit the show notes.
From Row to Plate, Wise Fish supports seafood businesses across aquaculture, fisheries, processing, and sales with one integrated platform. Trusted by companies around the world like Tassel, Niels Fehr, and others, Wise Fish helps control costs, improve margins, and enable smarter financial decisions, replacing spreadsheets and siloed systems. Learn more at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent.